With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
On September 5th, 1934, a 34-year-old man named Frank Lagasse was strolling along the Cleveland shores of Lake Erie. The beaches offered Cleveland residents an escape from the crowded inner city's dark, polluted streets and walkways. On this particular morning, however, Frank Lagasse got the shock of his life. Among the sand gravel, he found the dismembered torso of a woman. Only the thighs were still attached. No arms, no legs, no head. The sufficiently startled Lagasse called Cleveland police, and the county coroner at the time, A.J. Pierce, examined the body. He determined the woman had been dead for 6 months. The murderer dismembered her with expert precision with clean cuts made at the knees and upper waist, indicating the killer had at least a working knowledge of human anatomy. The body was coated in some sort of chemical preservative, enabling it to remain intact in the water for what he estimated was about 3 months. The skin was tough, leathery, and red. Who was this woman? Police named her the Lady of the Lake, but they had virtually no clues. This appeared to be a tragic, yet isolated incident. No one could conclude it was even a homicide. That is, until almost exactly 1 year later, in September of 1935, when two more bodies were discovered. Then, two more after that. By June 1936, police and the Cleveland press knew that these 5 bodies, all expertly dismembered, decapitated, and left in the same general area, were more than just disturbing coincidences. This was the work of one sick killer, and he was far from finished. Several decades before the term was coined, Cleveland had its very own bona fide serial killer. This is the story of the Cleveland Torso Murderer, also known as the Kingsbury Run Murders. Cleveland, Ohio, like so many other United States cities in the 1930s, was ravaged by economic devastation caused by the Great Depression. At the turn of the 20th century, up until 1927, Cleveland had flourished. With a population of just under 1 million people, it was the 6th largest city in the US. Being located near major waterways and the sophisticated railway system within its borders made Cleveland a prime location for business and manufacturing. Before the Great Depression hit in 1929, 41% of Cleveland's workforce held manufacturing jobs, and unemployment was basically non-existent. Cleveland had been a city of prosperity, but by 1931, nearly 100,000 people were out of work, with another 25,000 either laid off or working part-time. Scores of businesses and factories closed by the day. The city's numerous charitable organizations tried to ease the suffering by orchestrating bread lines and soup kitchens. Still, because the number of desperate people was rising by the day, they had to rely on local government subsidies to keep afloat. And that was money that the city of Cleveland just didn't have. People out of work, out of money, and on the verge of eviction rioted on the steps of City Hall. In February 1930, over 1,000 protesters tried to storm the city council chambers in what was known as the Red Job Riot. One industry that did not suffer through the Depression era was the bootlegging business. The stock market crash of 1929 that ultimately led to the economic collapse commonly known as the Great Depression occurred when Prohibition, the federal amendment banning the production and sale of intoxicating liquors, was still in full force. Organized crime flourished, and the people's relationship with Cleveland law enforcement deteriorated. Cleveland's police and city government earned a national reputation for being some of the most corrupt in the country. Even after Prohibition was repealed in December of 1933, steep federal alcohol taxes kept the alcohol black market alive. Police accepted bribes and payouts and looked the other way when necessary. The situation was rife with lawlessness, and things only got worse as the years wore on. By 1933, 219,000 people in Cleveland were out of work. Homeowners were foreclosed on, and renters evicted. This facilitated the rise of Hoovervilles, better known as shantytowns. Scores of people without anywhere to go built makeshift villages on vacant land throughout the city using crates, driftwood, discarded sheet metal, and even old bed sheets to craft shelters. There were a half dozen shantytowns in Cleveland alone. Most notably, the East Side slum known as Kingsbury Run that housed the Red Light District, the Roaring Third, which is the backdrop of our story today. In September of 1934, a killer began preying upon the vulnerable people in Kingsbury Run. But aside from the first week after the Lady of the Lake was discovered, no one paid much attention to the tragic event. Cleveland had bigger problems to worry about in the throes of the Great Depression. One year later, however, in September of 1935, after the bodies of two men were found at the bottom of the unfortunately named Jackass Hill, the situation became more alarming. A 16-year-old boy walking about in Kingsbury Run came across the headless and castrated torso of a male. The man, determined to be in his late 20s, was completely naked, save for a pair of cotton socks. Police showed up and located not only the head of the victim, but also a second victim, a man in his 40s, who was also dismembered, decapitated, and castrated. Again, coroner A.J. Pierce examined the bodies and determined they'd been skillfully disarticulated with confident cuts at the joints. He found their skin had been coated in a preservative and looked reddish and leathery, just like the Lady of the Lake. What made these murders particularly brutal, aside from the total dismemberment of the body, is the coroner determined their cause of death had been decapitation. They had been killed by having their heads chopped off. Fortunately for the police, the younger man's body still had his hands attached. Through fingerprints, they were able to identify him as Edward Andrussy, a 28-year-old former hospital orderly and Kingsbury Run resident, who had previous run-ins with law enforcement for carrying concealed weapons. Andrussy had been living with his parents when he disappeared. His father told police he'd had an altercation with a local mobster a few weeks prior and was in constant fear for his life. This led police to wonder if these crimes had been mob hits, distinctive murders committed to make a point and scare off some other people. Edward Andrussy often frequented the Roaring Third, a district rife with mob activity, sex work, and gambling. A few months went by without any additional leads, and public interest in the cases went dormant. Not to mention, police and city officials were preoccupied with a new development. They were about to get a new sheriff in town. In the fall of 1935, around the same time that Edward Andrussy's body and the second unidentified male were found in Kingsbury Run, Cleveland's newly elected mayor, Harold Burton, was working on cleaning up Cleveland's law enforcement. His first step? Find a law enforcement officer with integrity to take on the momentous job of becoming Cleveland's public safety director. The position had very high stakes. The director was essentially the overlord of the police and fire departments. both of whom, by 1935, were understaffed, poorly trained, ill-equipped, and wholly corrupted by the city's organized crime. Even after Prohibition was repealed on December 5th, 1933, the high federal tax on liquor kept bootleggers selling under-the-table booze in businesses. Police officers regularly accepted bribes to look the other way, and Mayor Burton was tired of the terrible reputation Cleveland had sustained. He turned his efforts towards wooing a very famous and very young lawman living in Cincinnati named Elliot Ness. 31-year-old Elliot Ness made a name for himself in Chicago during the late 1920s for busting up illegal alcohol operations, notably Al Capone and his Chicago outfit. Ness's team was nicknamed the Untouchables for their seemingly incorruptible integrity and refusal to accept bribes. Ness had even been the inspiration behind Dick Tracy, the comic about a tough and quick-witted detective, created in 1931 by Chester Gould. In late 1933, Ness was transferred from Chicago to Cincinnati as assistant investigator in charge of the Cincinnati Alcohol Tax Unit. That's where he was when Mayor Barton called to offer him the job in December of 1935. Elliot Ness immediately accepted the job as Cleveland's public safety director. He packed up his house with his wife Edna, and the family moved to Cleveland. Once there, he expected to clean up the town by busting illegal clubs, firing corrupt police officers, and upgrading department equipment and training. All in all, he was going to revitalize Cleveland's law enforcement. Little did he know, the crimes of this mysterious, deranged killer would overshadow his many achievements and become a defining part of his career. While Elliot Ness hit the ground running on reducing police corruption, residents of Kingsbury Run were about to find another dismembered corpse. On January 26th, 1936, a barking dog behind Hart Manufacturing drew the attention of a woman nearby. The pup was straining against its chain to get to two bushel baskets covered in burlap. The woman lifted the covering, took a quick peek, then made her way to a nearby butcher shop to tell the owner that there were a couple of baskets of ham in the alleyway. Thinking he'd been burglarized, the owner rushed outside to take a look, but upon seeing the contents, his stomach turned. Those weren't hams in those baskets. They were human body parts, a female torso, arms, and legs wrapped neatly in newspaper. Her reproductive organs had been removed, again with the same technical precision as the last several victims. Her head was never recovered. Police used fingerprints to determine her identity. This fourth victim was Flo Palio, a 42-year-old part-time sex worker, barmaid, and housewife who spent copious amounts of time on the Roaring Third, just like Edward Andrassy. Police again wondered if this was a mob hit, as Flo was connected with this seedy underworld. Press noted the similarities between Flo's murder and the Lady of the Lake from 1934. All of these macabre killings were a little too similar for comfort. Any doubt about a multiple murderer was removed in June 1936 when a fifth dismembered victim was found. Two young boys were skipping school and wandering around the aforementioned Jackass Hill when they found a pair of balled-up pants at the base of a tree. They unrolled the pants, thinking they might find something interesting. They weren't wrong. Staring back at them was the decapitated head of a man in his 20s. Terrified, the boys ran home and told their mothers, who then took them to the police to tell their gruesome tale. Police found the body of the man a few hundred yards away from his head. He had been drained of blood, castrated, and covered in the same chemical preservative as the other victims. Just like Edward Andrassy, he was young, but police could not identify him via fingerprints. However, he did have several distinctive tattoos on his arms, so detectives decided to ask the public for help identifying the man. They set up a public viewing of the body at the morgue, where hundreds of Clevelanders lined up to catch a glimpse of this mystery man. Sadly, they had no luck. Elliot Ness made the decision to take it to a larger audience. He had the man's plastered death mask and a drawn tattoo map of his body art displayed at the Great Lakes Exposition, a World's Fair-style exhibit that attracted over 100,000 visitors. Sadly, again, no one could identify him. At this point, two full-time investigators, Peter Murillo and Martin Zalewski, were assigned to the case. But Elliot Ness still kept it at arm's length. He was busting up corrupt police precincts all over Cleveland, but come September of 1936, he could not keep out of it any longer. On September 10th, 1936, a transient man riding the rails was running to catch a train when he spotted a body floating in a nearby cesspool. According to some sources, he actually tripped over some body parts. This man alerted police to the body, and soon word got out to the public. Hundreds of spectators crowded around the crime scene to watch police fish the sixth torso victim out of the dirty water. There, they found his upper torso and extremities, but just like the others, this body had been castrated and drained of blood. The victim's head was never found. Tensions were continuing to rise. After the discovery of this sixth victim, the county coroner told the press, "The killer is apparently a sex maniac of the sadistic type. This is indicated by the condition of his victims. He is probably a muscular man. The slayer definitely has expert knowledge of human anatomy. The incisions of his knife are clean and were made in each case without guesswork. He may have gathered his knowledge of anatomy as a medical student, or it is possible that he is a butcher." This statement turned the situation into a public relations nightmare. Suddenly, the public was in an uproar. Who was this sadistic killer? Why hadn't the police found him after six victims? Mayor Burton and his administration went into damage control mode, and Elliot Ness was instructed to make the torso killer his top priority. Unfortunately, Ness was very much out of his depth with this sort of crime. He was used to dealing with organized crime, not sporadic, unpredictable serial murderers. Despite this, Ness threw the full weight of the Cleveland PD at this investigation. When all was said and done, Detectives Peter Murillo and Martin Zalewski interviewed over 1,000 people over the course of the investigation, and the police department as a whole interviewed over 5,000. Still, it did not make a difference. Now, we're going to pause for just a moment to hear a word from today's sponsors.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Today's episode is brought to you by Caliper CBD. CBD is something that I never really thought of before I started this podcast. However, it's become a valuable part of my daily regimen over the past year or two. In particular, the CBD powder produced by Caliper. It's incredibly simple to just open up a tiny packet of Caliper's CBD powder and add it to a drink of choice. You know, a coffee, water, anything. And the nearly flavorless powder goes to work fast, helping calm me and relieve some of the stress that comes from being a new parent. Best of all, Caliper's CBD powder is the only clinically proven fast-acting CBD, which delivers 30 times more CBD in the first 30 minutes than CBD oil. Each packet comes with 20 milligrams of fast-acting THC and GMO-free CBD powder, which is free of fillers, added chemicals, or artificial flavors. Get 20% off of your first order when you use the promo code UNRESOLVED at trycaliper.com/unresolved. You can try Caliper CBD risk-free for 30 days. If you don't like it, they'll give you a full refund. Once again, take advantage of this offer by heading to trycaliper.com/unresolved. That's trycaliper.com/unresolved. And don't forget to use the offer code UNRESOLVED at checkout to save 20%. Now, let's return to the show. On February 23rd, 1937, what was described as a young mother's upper torso washed up on Beulah Park Beach, almost in the exact same spot as the Lady of the Lake. Police could not identify her. On June 6th, 1937, the skeletal remains of a woman in her 40s were found under the Lorraine Carnegie Bridge near downtown Cleveland. The county coroner noted some unique dental work and was able to identify her as Rose Wallace, a part-time sex worker and another regular of the Roaring Third. Despite the identification, police had no leads on who might have killed and dismembered her. A month later, in July, police recovered pieces of a male body from the Cuyahoga River. The victim's torso had all of the internal organs removed except for the lungs. Again, police were unable to make an identification. Things went cold for about 8 months after the quick succession of victims 7, 8, and 9. Elliot Ness had no new leads, and his detectives were exhausting all of the older ones. The press was relentless. Why couldn't the police catch this killer? How many people had to die before they figured out his identity? Then, in March of 1938, a man walking his dog in the nearby town of Sandusky got the shock of his life. His dog came running out of the woods with a human leg in its mouth. The local coroner noted the precision of the amputation and immediately called police. The head of Cleveland's Scientific Identification Bureau, David Cowles, went to Sandusky to investigate. It just so happened, Cowles had an informant in the nearby Osborne State Prison who could not stop talking about a character named Francis Sweeney. Sweeney was a Cleveland doctor with a drinking problem, and he often checked himself into rehab at the Ohio Soldiers and Sailors Home, which just so happened to be in Sandusky. So, who was this Francis Sweeney? A World War I veteran, Francis Sweeney appeared to suffer from intense PTSD back when it was still called shell shock. He also apparently suffered nerve damage after being gassed in battle. Due to a lack of understanding around psychological issues like PTSD at the time, Francis Sweeney's mental health allegedly deteriorated over time despite being a brilliant doctor and surgeon. Twice, his wife appeared in probate court to have Francis committed to a psychiatric institution before she finally filed for divorce in 1934. She told the court that he neglected his medical practice, drank excessively, and disappeared for days at a time. In an ironic and unfortunate twist for the investigators, Sweeney's cousin was a Democratic congressman in Ohio named Martin Sweeney. Congressman Sweeney had been relentlessly criticizing Mayor Burton and Elliot Ness for their handling of the torso murders. Elliot Ness put Francis Sweeney under surveillance as a secret suspect. If word got back to Congressman Sweeney that his cousin was the main suspect in the torso murders, things might get ugly for investigators. Nothing came of these tales. It's almost as if Francis Sweeney had experience hiding his whereabouts from others. A month later, in April 1938, the torso of a female victim washed up on the banks of the Cuyahoga River in two burlap bags. This was the first victim in which the coroner found drugs in their system. Had they been used to incapacitate her? This 10th victim was apparently too much for Elliot Ness. He had investigators kidnap Francis Sweeney from a downtown street corner and take him to a darkened suite at the Cleveland Hotel. Elliot Ness kept Francis Sweeney in that hotel room for over a week while his investigators interrogated him. Notably, David Cowles was also there. This becomes important later on. They believed that they had their man, and they weren't planning on leaving that hotel room until they had secured a confession. There was only one problem. Sweeney wouldn't give it up. At the time they nabbed him, Francis Sweeney was on the tail end of a bender. It allegedly took him several days to sober up before officials could get coherent answers out of him. And even then, he answered in the form of riddles and cryptic messages. After days of this, Elliot Ness became so frustrated that he called in an expert, Leonard Keeler. Keeler was a pioneer in the then cutting-edge technology of the polygraph test, aka the lie detector. Keeler administered the test to Sweeney several times, and when he was done, he reportedly told Ness, "That's your man. Might as well throw my machine at the window if I say anything different." Still, Francis Sweeney did not say anything legally incriminating, even after, presumably, several beatings from labored and frustrated detectives. Plus, there was the matter of Sweeney's powerful congressional cousin. Elliot Ness had no choice but to let him go. There were only two more additional torso victims after the unofficial interrogation of Dr. Francis Sweeney. On August 16, 1938, three vagrants were scrounging for goods at a dump site when they uncovered the torso of a woman. She was wrapped once in a blue men's blazer and again in a threadbare quilt. While police processed the scene, they found the dismembered body of a man. Both of these bodies, coincidentally, were placed within sight of Elliot Ness's office. 2 days later, in what looked like an absolute irrational fury, Elliot Ness mustered a few dozen police officers and firefighters and performed a raid on Kingsbury Run. There, they evicted over 300 people and arrested as many as 65 for being homeless before burning the shantytown to the ground. Elliot Ness believed his logic to be sound. Kingsbury Run was the killer's hunting ground, and if you want to get rid of a predator, you have to get rid of its food source. However, the press and the public were rightfully outraged. Ness had torn needy people away from the only place they had to go and burned their only belongings. This was the Great Depression, after all. Times were incredibly tough. Papers called him a man with misguided zeal and pointed out this action would in no way help him solve the torso murders. But, for some inexplicable reason, Ness might have been right. The murders stopped. It should also be noted that Dr. Francis Sweeney checked himself back into rehab approximately 2 weeks later. 1 year after the burning of Kingsbury Run, in July of 1939, police finally made an arrest in connection to the case, taking into custody a 54-year-old bricklayer named Frank Dolezal. Dolezal had lived with Flo Polio in the early 30s and had known both Rose Wallace and Edward Andrassy from time spent in the Roaring Third. Investigators believed their case to be a slam dunk and allegedly beat Frank Dolezal until he confessed to Flo's murder. He recanted soon after, but in August, he was found dead in his jail cell from an apparent suicide, although few believed he actually killed himself. Frank Dolezal was 5 feet 8 inches tall, and he was found hanging from a hook that was an inch shorter than he was. Plus, it wasn't believed that he had the skills to carve up bodies like the torso killer. Very few people with knowledge of the investigation believed that Frank Dolezal had the know-how or the capacity to commit such murders. As far as the Cleveland press was concerned, the torso murders remained unsolved, but Elliot Ness always maintained that he had figured it out. He just couldn't prove it. The officials who participated in Francis Sweeney's hotel interrogation were sworn to secrecy, and remained so until David Cowles gave an interview to the Cleveland Police Historical Society in 1983. He refused to name names, but he gave enough details to make it obvious he was talking about Francis Sweeney, i.e., the man was a doctor and had a cousin who was a congressman. Sound familiar? Thank you. In August of 1938, Cleveland investigators caught wind of a story that had happened a few years prior, in November of 1934. A man named Emil Fronek had been a drifter wandering around downtown Cleveland looking for a meal when a doctor approached him. He said he wound up in a second-floor doctor's office, but he began to feel dizzy and was afraid that he had been drugged. After running out of the building, he said he ended up on a train and slept for 3 days before coming to. When he went back to look for the doctor's office, he couldn't find it. Investigators drove Emil Fronek down Broadway hoping he could recall something, but unfortunately, he didn't. According to Cleveland torso killer researcher James Badal, the great-nephew of a doctor named Edward Paterka approached him after giving a lecture sometime in the early 2000s with a very old photo. It was a picture of several doctors from the 1930s. Francis Sweeney was in this photo, and the great-nephew of Edward Paterka told Badal that the doctors in that picture practiced together in a building at the Broadway and Pershing Avenues. If true, this legitimizes Emil Fronek's story and makes a strong case for Sweeney being the perpetrator. Then, there were the postcards. In the 1950s, Elliot Ness started receiving taunting postcards called F.E. Sweeney, Paranoidal Nemesis. According to James Badal, they mainly were incoherent, but taunted Ness for not finding the killer. Sadly, Elliot Ness's reputation as an honest crime fighter with a propensity for justice would never recover from his disastrous run in Cleveland. His behavior during his hunt for the torso killer burned many professional bridges, and a series of high-profile failures in his personal life, including a few divorces and a drunk driving arrest, which he tried to have covered up, resulted in him eventually leaving town. Elliot Ness died of a heart attack in his home in 1957, having spent his final years in relative squalor and obscurity. Following his death, however, his image was rehabilitated in a number of creative mediums, including a 1959 TV series called The Untouchables, in which Ness was portrayed by Unsolved Mysteries host Robert Stack, as well as a 1987 film of the same name, in which he was played by Kevin Costner. His apparent foil in real life, Dr. Francis Sweeney, did not make it much longer than him. Sweeney, who had been found sane following two court-ordered psychiatric evaluations in 1938, was eventually diagnosed as a schizophrenic in 1956. He had committed himself to a veterans hospital in 1938, emerging the following year, which Ness claimed helped him avoid prosecution. In the years to come, Sweeney would reportedly send taunting messages to Elliot Ness, the aforementioned postcards, but would himself die in 1964, having not been charged with any of the torso killings. Of the numerous victims, only three were ever identified: Edward Andrassy, Florence Palio, and Rose Wallace. The other nine souls, whose lives were taken by this unknown menace, remain forever unknown. Altogether, their stories remain unresolved. Thank you for listening to this episode of Unresolved. Research and writing for this episode was carried out by Maggie Coomer. Production was done by me, your host, Michael Whelan. The music for this episode was composed by myself through Amper Music, except for the song you're hearing now, the Unresolved theme song, written and composed by Ailsa Traves. To get a full list of sources and references, you can check out the podcast website at unresolved.me. There, each story has its own page, where you can check out our sources or follow along with a transcript of each episode. If you would like to help support this podcast and gain access to the archive of exclusive digital content and other perks, please head to patreon.com/unresolvedpod or search for Unresolved Pod in the Patreon app. On a personal note, before I end this episode, I would like to thank all of you for your patience and support over the past several months. Things have been pretty stressful and hectic for me on a personal level, but my wife gave birth to a beautiful baby girl in early June, causing the rather quick end to the prior season. This break, however, has allowed me to recharge my batteries, so to speak, even though I'm still getting used to this new normal, which includes sleep deprivation and a lot of diapers and spit up. I'm incredibly excited to begin a new season of this show with some new recording equipment, a new setup, a new logo, and brand new stories. So until next time, I hope you all stay safe, and I will talk to you later.